On today's episode of Tips on the Top Floor, Alan Attridge joins us to discuss how to up your videography game as a run-and-gun shooter. This episode is supported by discoverthetopfloor.com. Join us on one of the spectacular 2019 photo tours for some amazing photography in northern Norway on a ship around the Lofoten Archipelago or on the Bohemian Castles tour to Prague and the Czech Republic to Kyrgyzstan, one of the most beautiful landscapes and cultures along the Silk Road, or to capture the breathtaking fall colors of Romania and Transylvania in fall. Spend a week or two dedicated entirely to photography and to great cultural experiences. Meet like-minded people, learn from the best, and see places that you always wanted to see or that you didn't even know existed. Find out more at discoverthetopfloor.com. That's discoverthetopfloor.com. This is Tips from the Top Floor, episode 850 for Thursday, December the 13th, 2018. Tips from the top floor, tips from the top. Hey, hello, welcome. It is Chris, and you're listening to Tips from the Top Floor, the podcast about all things photography. It's interview time again. Yep. Today I will talk with Alan Attridge about video, all things video. Before that, the last Slack challenge is officially over. Thanks all for your contributions. Awesome stuff. But because the interview is a bit longer than usual, I have moved the Slack review into the next episode. So you have something to look forward to for next week. That's also when Matt will give you the next Slack challenge, which is another exciting one. And this time we will have a bit more than a month to submit your pictures. So everything will be good. Let's not waste any time here. Back to the interview. Last week, I sat down with Alan Attridge. Alan is a professional filmmaker. Among other things, he shoots for Adam Carolla. He travels the world, knows a lot about shooting video, and has a lot of experience and has some great tips for you to up your game. Alan is also a podcaster. Longtime listeners will know that Alan and I go way back to the time when I still lived in Tübingen, in southern Germany. He's the host of the Two Hosers podcast, which is the perfect show for the person in your life who starts out in photography right now. So check those out. Links are in the show notes. And now, without further ado, here we go. Enjoy. Alan, how are you?
Oh, we're starting now.
Yeah, we're starting now.
Okay, I'm doing good. And yourself?
I'm doing awesome. I'm in the middle of editing a video project that I recorded in, well, I didn't shoot it, John shot it in Rochester. Okay. And I have like 4 hours of audio and video. I'm trying to make sense of it.
Hours of audio and 4 hours of video separately.
Well, it's 4 hours of audio from two lavalier mics. It's about 2 hours of video, and yeah, just audio in between. We had little recorders on people, so it was recording permanently. And John did the heavy lifting in terms of the synchronizing of all these snippets. Mm-hmm. You know, the video comes on and off and on and off, and it has to be synchronized to that long, long audio track.
Indeed, yes.
And John has this magical tool. It's not cheap. It's called Pluralize. Mm-hmm. And it magically syncs everything up. And so that is taken care of. But now I have this huge bunch of stuff, and I was wondering. I mean, you are a professional video guy. You do this kind of stuff every day, so I was wondering, like someone like me who doesn't shoot a lot of video, but then every now and then gets like these huge chunks in, and mm-hmm. has to make something out of that. Do you have any tips for people like us, the still shooters that every now and then do video? And we could start really, really basic. I mean, we can start with just some general stuff, how to shoot and how to make sense of it.
Sure. Well, sounds like you had a very, very small crew.
It was a one-person camera crew and myself running pretty much.
That's kind of what happens a lot now. I mean, you mm-hmm. go into a movie set and there's a lot of people. And there's a reason for that. I mean, there's a lot to do, but more often than not, you're going to find yourself, you're going to be the one man gang.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be difficult, but it can also be pretty satisfying. And it's kind of how I prefer to shoot myself. So I think the first tip when you said, hey, can you give me some tips on shooting video? The first thing that came to mind is something I deal with all the time is when clients ask, can you shoot video? Yes, I can. What about stills? Can you shoot stills? Yes, I can. Can you do both? Well, not at the same time. And I don't mean that jokingly. It's, you know what? I can babysit your two-year-old, or I can replace the transmission in your 1978 Ford Granada. But not at the same time. And if I do them at the same time, I'm not going to do a good job of either. And so even though shooting stills and video has this massive overlap in skill set,
I mean, it's
really difficult.
In the perception of a client, I think it does. I mean, you're holding a camera, you're looking through it, and you're pressing a button. That's what you
right.
do from their point of view. But yeah, they're different skill sets for sure.
Now, I think it's actually getting easier and easier. I mean, with the advent of mirrorless and all this, it kind of makes it a little easier to do. But generally, if you want to go out and shoot video, my first tip is to focus on shooting video. Just specify that that's what you're there to do. Any other stills that you might grab, maybe you get them, maybe you don't. But if you want to be really good at it, just focus on shooting video.
Okay.
From then, a lot of it, like I said, a lot of crossover. You want to get good light, all the same things as you want for shooting stills are going to apply to your video. But where to go to next?
Well, I mean, it's a different thing in as you have the motion factor, you have the timing factor that you don't have with stills. So I would think you would probably frame differently and do things in video that you just can't do in stills.
You have to be conscious that, like, you're shooting 24 still. Well, you're probably shooting 24 frames per second, but you're shooting 24 stills a second. And you don't... And, you know, you are going to cut away, et cetera, later on. But generally, you have to consider that, you know, when you're shooting, maybe you're shooting stills, you can snap a photo, wait a couple of seconds, move around, snap another photo. You don't have to worry about snapping photos in that time that you're moving. Whereas when you're shooting video, you better be shooting the whole time. You can't just move the camera. You can't wander off. You have to be conscious of it being one continuous shot. And that's where it gets very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the whole other aspect to worry about, which is the audio, sounds like what you're going through now,
which is a lot more important. I mean, no, the audio we did on that shoot, we did what we've done in the past, and we're capturing audio separately from the video, so we have two different media streams that we have to sync up later. And
right.
that made things a lot easier because it meant that we could just stick a little recording device on someone, didn't have to worry about radio transmission to the camera and that kind of stuff, or long dangling cables. Mm-hmm. So it made the shooting easier, but then in post-production, it made things a bit harder. But in general, I mean, the good sound, that's what I know from my past as a sound guy, is that if you want to capture good sound, try to get the microphone as close to the source as possible. Which,
sure.
With a camera, it's not easy to use the microphone that's built into the camera and have it sound good in interview situations, because the camera tends to be further away from the subject.
Or your subject looks terrible because you have the camera right in their face.
And have a better sound, but yeah, have big noses instead. So you have the pretty much the if you only have one camera with a built-in microphone, that's one of the issues that you are going to face.
Well, if you have a DSLR and you're just using the built-in microphone, you're going to have trouble even recording a scratch track. Meaning a temporary track that you're going to use later to replace. It's just the microphones that are built into the cameras are not very good.
Well, at least the software that you can use today, and if I use Final Cut Pro 10 here, and it has like a synchronization built in, so it will look at the what you call the scratch track, the track on the DSLR, the audio track, and it will look at the separate audio that you give it, and it will find where they belong together and how they sync up. And but the situation that we had was like, okay, 700 snippets of video and two separate audio tracks, and that just needs some special tools to kind of get all together into one. But I do have good sound now. I have synchronized sound now. I have a ton of video, and of course I will not release a 2-hour video out of that. Editing this down into 5-minute pieces, maybe.
Which audio recorders are you using?
The Tascam DR110.
Yes, I have 3 of those.
Yeah, which I think you recommended to me and other people too. And it's this little, tiny little. It's like half the size of a pack of cards, maybe, and
or even smaller, I think.
Yeah. Or even smaller, and it comes with a lavalier microphone, one that you pin to your lapel, and you just put it in someone's pocket and forget about it, and it runs for hours and hours on one battery.
It is amazing. And so, but you know, back in the old days, and I still have my radio mic. I bought a radio mic, a Sennheiser, when they became affordable, because even before that, the industry standard was a product called made by Electrosonics. And you could buy one mic pack, meaning a transmitter and a receiver. It was about $4,000 US. and they were excellent. Like, they were great mics. I don't know if that included the lav mic or not. That was just the pack. And so that was kind of out of range for most people, most independent kind of run and gun style guys. And then Sennheiser had their Evolution series, which I think I paid around $800 for.
Oh, that's a long time ago. Quite a bargain compared to the old
Sure. One. And they're very good. They weren't quite as good as the Electrosonics, but it was very, very good setup, and they've since come down in price, but they're pretty big and pretty heavy. Like, they're metal. They were the size of a pack of cards and then some, a little bit bigger than that. And it was made of metal. It took a 9-volt that lasted about an hour and a half. And then it would, you'd mount the similar sized receiver on the camera. And for the most part, assuming you weren't near an airport or any other transmission area, you'd get pretty good audio. You'd get really good audio with the occasional dropout or a mic hit or just some sort of static hit, which is kind of annoying. When they came out with the digital recorders, which I think they did a long time ago, but they never really caught on until a couple of years ago. This was a massive game changer, because these little units run on, I think it's one, is it's one AAA battery, I think, isn't it?
I think it's one AAA or one AA, but it's a tiny, it doesn't take a lot of energy, that thing runs for.
It shows you how often I change the batteries. I'm not even sure.
As I said, I put this microphone on someone. I started the recording on the full battery, and we recorded for over 4 hours straight the audio. And then in the end, the battery was still over half full.
Right. Now, the downside is you can't ride levels. Like, you don't have a dedicated audio, like a audio mixer on location. Like, when they shoot, you know, the Hollywood movies, the audio team is usually, you know, 2-3 guys or women. And who go out there, and there's one guy operating, one guy recording, and watching levels, and
you would see that one guy having a pack over their shoulder, hanging off of their, like, a big old transistor radio thing hanging over their shoulder, and then they'd have the, what do you call that, pole with the microphone at the end.
We call it the fish pole. Most people call it the boom pole.
The fish pole, boom pole. And then they'd have a big pair of headphones on just to monitor everything and make sure they get the sound right. But that's a million-dollar Hollywood production. So
that is a big-time production. And I've seen the guys who are the recorders. Like, you have one guy with the fish pole. He'll be a separate guy to the recorder. And let's say they're going to be running audio. They're going to be running radio mics.
There must be a union involved somewhere.
Oh, but you need those guys when you do it. That you know, that big of a production, because you might have multiple booms on one scene.
Right.
And so, you know, and they'll have giant, like they'll have, this guy had a giant antenna, like for the receiver. He didn't have the little on-camera mic pack receiver. He had a giant, like a 1973 TV antenna that he, yes, that he would stand.
Okay. So now we have a tiny little recorder that disappears in your pocket and a little lavalier.
And they aren't
mic.
Perfect. That's the thing. They aren't perfect, but for what you want to do.
Oh, plenty
they
good
are
enough.
As close to perfect as you can get. Because
you know the microphone. Okay. So we had two microphones. We had one on the guy that I worked with, and we had one on myself. And the one on the guy was the little Tascam box, and that sound, and it was set on to auto, which I hate because I'm an audio guy. I want control over that, but it's so good. It was so. And by the way, we're not selling this thing here. This is not sponsored at all. It's just a great little toy. This was good enough for what we needed, and then my audio track was going to a belt pack, a little transmitter, and into the camera that way. Mm-hmm. So that, I don't even know what that was, probably a Shure system, and that didn't sound nearly as good as the little Tascam thing.
Right.
So it was like roomy, more noisy, and I'm just blown away. I think I need a second one of those.
Yeah, and they're not, but a couple of $100, I think.
Like $200.
Yeah. Mic included. Now, I don't shoot on auto. I like yourself. I kind of like to have the control, and even if the person talking, you know, goes up and down, I'd rather deal with that later. So generally, what I'll do is I'll set it to there's basically, I think there's four settings, like, you know, quiet, medium, loud, and extra loud, or something like that. And I set it to one, and then I run the dual recording.
Yeah,
which means it'll record a second track on a lower input level.
So the same thing goes to a second track, but it is more silent. So if something loud happens, you can use the audio from that second track.
Right, and it has a built-in limiter on that main track, which I do use. So if anything ever, you know, if it's reasonable, I can just use it with the limiter. If it's wildly distorted, I can use the second track, and that just records and records onto a. What is it? What are those mini SDs?
SD cards.
Micro SDs.
The reason I set mine to auto was because I knew we'd be there for like 4 or 5 hours, and we'd be in like 5 different environments, and we didn't have the time. We wanted to capture as much as possible, so right. We didn't have the time to go back to the audio and change stuff and go back. So this would just have limited our ability to capture this kind of a reportage style that we did.
And that's a big thing. That's the one thing that people don't think about when they think, you know, I want to shoot videos. I'll do that in audio. I'm sure it'll be fine. It's not. You have to take a lot of care to shoot good audio.
And you know who this little box was designed for? Wedding shooters, like people who shoot video on weddings, and they also have to capture like a lot of different things. You can see this in the color choice. It comes in black and it comes in white.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So you can put it on a wedding dress and it'll be kind of inconspicuous in the video.
So that's step one. I don't think we need to get into the post-production on how to sync all this, but if you can.
Well, again, the tool that John used is called Plural Eyes, and he bought, I don't know, it's an expensive tool. I looked it up and then I decided not to get it. But for that kind of thing, John threw the whole video and stuff into Plural Eyes, and then it outputs like a file for your video editor. And you can choose like for Final Cut Pro 10, for example, which is what I use. Mm-hmm. So I ended up having this XML, FCP, XML, whatever file that then opens in my editor, and it has a pre-made project in there with all the video snippets and the audio tracks all nicely lined up. So that was a huge help. I couldn't have probably done it in any reasonable time. I would have given up in between trying to manually sync that stuff. So that's the kind of tool. And then you end up having a project. And with
there are ways around that. I have never used that. I've heard great things about it. There's built into whatever program you're editing with now generally has a lighter version of that built in.
True. And it works with simpler kind of setups. Like you have one audio track, you have one video track. Those will sync up in your video workstation for sure.
Right. Or you can go old school like I do. And so if you've seen any behind the scenes on any movies ever made, you'll see them, you know, scene one, take one, marker, and put the slate in.
And then you go, yeah, right.
And that's back in the old days when you recorded on a Nagra audio recorder and then you had film.
Oh,
and you
just I so want one of those.
The Nagra?
The old Nagras, the Swiss-made Nagras, the little tape recorders. Oh, man. I love those just for nostalgia reasons.
I cut my teeth on those. That was it's a whole other story. But anyways, so you'd mark down where the clapper happened on the audio, or mark it on the video, on the film, and the rest would sync up. And so generally, that's what I have. Now, that's hard to do in run and gun style, like documentary style footage, unless you're doing interviews. But generally, what I'll have my subjects do is just self slate, meaning they'll just. Can you clap for me once right in front of your face?
That's so you have it on video and on audio.
Correct. And you can tell the people who've done it before. And the ones who really know what they're doing don't even have to be asked. They'll just yell out self-slate and do that. And there's a guy who I shot who did that named Keanu Reeves. He just knew. He looked at the situation and said, all right, here we go. Slate.
You shot Keanu Reeves?
A couple years ago, yeah.
Awesome.
At Goodwood, at the car race.
Okay.
And so he knew what was going on.
He's a pro. He knows that stuff, yeah.
Oh, it's not his first time. But then you deal with people who've never done it before, and so you ask them, can you clap for me once? And they think you're messing with them. Like this is some sort of a test. And I said, no, I don't want to explain it. Okay, fine. Video's here, audio's here. I got to put them together later. This clap will help me do it. Okay, please clap for me. And then they'll kind of give a half-hearted one off screen.
All right, so you end up having video, audio synchronized, somehow synchronized in your video editing software of choice.
If you can do it, my point is if you can do it, have your subject clap for you. It'll make your life way easier later. Okay, yes.
It does help. So now the kind of thing we did, again, we didn't know what to expect. So we shot and shot and shot as much as we could and later went through the sorting. It was not a planned shoot. It was planned in as we knew when we were there, when we were going to be there. And right. We knew how long it was going to be. But then the content and everything, it was at the Rochester Institute of Technology at their photographic department. And one of their associate professors, Ted Kinsman, showed us around the fun stuff they do with scientific photography, high speed photography, and so on. So that's as much as we knew. And then we just asked him what are the cool things you can show us, and he showed us this and that and this and that. So then I end up having 4 hours of a mix of video and audio, and. I'm at the point now where I decided I will not make this into one long video. I could probably make a 1 hour video out of that or a 45 minute video out of that. But I decided to split it into individual segments about about a single topic. There was like a high speed balloon popping, and there was he showed us a scanning electron microscopy and, you know, stuff that doesn't really belong together. So I decided to make like shorter videos out of those. But then still, just the base material for one of those 5 minute videos is like an hour long.
Sure.
So, and I think you have this situation too. So how do you go about this? Because that 1 hour video is dead boring in most of the parts. There's lots of pauses in between and setting stuff up and stuff that doesn't really make the video interesting.
Okay, so I actually don't have this situation very often. I avoid this
at all costs. You plan better, right?
I try to, but I've also made enough mistakes on enough shoots that I can usually identify them on the next shoot, meaning I know what to avoid. And the one of the notes I made when I said we were going to talk was in just all caps, don't overshoot. Mm-hmm. Overshoot confuses things, and you'll find yourself sitting in post production with an hour of raw footage to make a 30-second clip, and you get paralysis of choice.
You have too much, and you don't want to kill your baby, so to speak, right?
Well, there is that. Hey, I took the time to shoot this, so I better use it. And,
right.
Well, it's terrible. Throw it out. You never should have shot it in the first place. So that's my one thing I suggest to people is even if you haven't planned, try not to overshoot on the day and think, okay, we'll shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot. We'll shoot whatever. Just keep always be shooting. And I've worked on projects with professional, really high-end guys who that's their attitude. Oh, don't just stand there, shoot something. You never know. You never know what we'll need. And I think, well, I know you're not going to, not only are you not going to need this, it's going to get in the way of you, of what you do need.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take massive time suck on the back end. Don't do it. Now,
so as a beginner, if someone starts off doing that, I think it's very typical that they overshoot, that they mm-hmm. rather have more than less stuff. So I know that being more conservative in the shooting is going to come with experience.
Well, there's a still version of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear this from people who are brand new and just think, well, I'll just shoot wide and I'll crop it later in post.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't really work out so well.
You lose pixels.
It can happen. I mean, you can get away with it, but it's not, you don't just buy a 28 millimeter lens, shoot everything like that. And then, yeah, I want something nice and tight. I'll just crop in.
Yep.
Don't do it. Shoot what you want. That's what I suggest. Now, obviously you want to shoot a little bit more than you're going to need. I like to keep my shooting ratio, which means how much raw footage I have compared to what the output is going to be. I like to keep that very, very tight.
How tight? One to 10, 1 to 5.
Oh, 10 to 1. 10 to 1 is 10 to I one. Think is too much.
It's too much.
Like for what I like to shoot. Now I did get my, when I started out at film school, we were still shooting. It was digital video just kind of come in with the VX1000, the Sony camera, but we were also shooting 24 millimeter film.
Oh, which is expensive. Yeah.
Yes. And, 24 millimeter, 16 millimeter film. I invented a film format right there on the spot.
I'm pretty sure it is out there somewhere.
Pretty sure it was 24 frames per second, but it was 16 mil film. That's all. Yes. There you go. So we're shooting 16 mil, and it's expensive. I think it was about, a dollar a foot to shoot. And I forget how many seconds you get out of that. 400 feet is 10 minutes. So you're looking at $400 to shoot, just to shoot 10 minutes of footage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's processing and all that put together and a transfer. So you're kind of expensive. So you want to be very, very careful with what you shoot. And so, you know, my final film project, I think it was like a maybe a 3 to 1, maybe a 2.5 to 1 shooting ratio.
Right.
And so I've kind of pushed that over into digital, even though digital is essentially quote unquote free. You can fill up your cards, you know, cards are cheap and big and, but your time is finite. Like when you want to go on the end of a project, you don't want to have to sift through a whole bunch of footage that you don't need.
So how do you keep that ratio down if you don't really know what's going to happen? Sorry for the brief interruption. Before Alan answers this question, let me just take a brief second to thank this week's sponsor, Honeybook. Do you own a small business? Are you frustrated by dealing with back and forth emails, endless paperwork, and getting paid? Honeybook.com can help you spend less time handling the administration work and more time doing what you love. Honeybook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. Honeybook makes it easy to streamline your process with client and calendar management tools and custom branded brochures, proposals, and contracts. You can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, and get paid faster. all within one online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands of hours a year with HoneyBook. And that's why TFTTF has partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer you, the listeners, 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with promo code TOPFLOOR. So get started at HoneyBook.com today and use promo code TOPFLOOR for 50% off your first year. That's half off. That's HoneyBook.com, promo code TOPFLOOR. On with the show.
Well,
you have to probably anticipate a lot, right?
You do anticipate a lot, but also there's the one little, the main thing I can say is that while you're not overshooting, you do want to get your coverage. So if you've got the guy talking about your, you know, the balloon popping in slow motion, for example, obviously you're going to want to shoot, you want a shot of the balloon popping.
Oh, sure.
But maybe you want to get a quick 3-second shot of his hands setting up the balloon, or I'm trying to figure out how a balloon popping in slow motion occurs.
So the setup is you have a balloon, you have a camera like a DSLR pointing at you with the balloon in your hand, and then they freeze the motion of the popping balloon by killing the lights and firing a flash based on the sound of the balloon. So you get like a open shutter, brief burst, like 20,000th of a second of flash, and then the lights come back on and the balloon is popped and the picture is hopefully in the DSLR.
So something like this is going to be maybe 5 minutes of him talking about it?
In this case, it was a class that he held in front of students, so he was spending more time on that. So we were talking that whole thing with several people doing it. So we have like 10 people popping a balloon. We have him explaining the whole thing for 20 minutes. So it was hard to anticipate what he would say when, so that's why we shot the whole thing. And editing that down, yep, it takes time. We have a few really good bits, and it's really painful to throw away a lot of it. I think the result is okay if you have the stamina to edit all that. And I think I've spent on that popping the balloon section, I think I've spent probably an hour editing that now, which is okay. It feels
and the
still
final
okay.
Output's going to be how long?
Oh, 5 to 8 minutes.
Sure, that sounds about right.
And but I have one problem. Okay, so here's a very, very, very concrete problem. You want to edit down what someone says, 10 minutes of him talking into like half a minute to 1 minute maximum, and you end up with a lot of weird looking cuts because the camera's on his face.
As long as they sound good, you're going to be okay, though.
They sound fine, but you get a lot of what I think is called jump cuts, where nothing changes but his face. So he jumps. It's visually weird.
So when I shoot this, how I end up shooting this is I'll shoot his whole speech. So you say it's an hour, 10 minutes, whatever it is. I'll shoot the 10 minutes and want to cut it down to a minute. So what I'll do is I take that 10 and then I'll just go through and cut it to what they call a talk line. So I don't care what it looks like, the jump cuts, as long as it sounds good to me.
Okay.
As long as it sounds as if with my eyes closed, it sounds like it's one continuous speech. And then I go through and I look and identify all those jump cuts that you're talking about. Now, you don't notice the jump cuts in audio. You only notice them in video because that's what changes. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go in and cover those. Now, because on the day when he was giving his speech, either we had two cameras rolling or probably not. I don't typically shoot with two cameras because that doubles your footage you have to sift through later. But what I will do is in the next speech he's giving about something completely unrelated, I will go and stand next to him and just pick up shots of the audience looking at him. These will be cutaways. And so now we have someone nodding and, that sounds interesting. And then I'll cut like a 2-second clip in. Every time there's a jump cut, we cut to an audience member nodding knowingly, even though it's from a completely different speech. We don't have to, Am I showing behind the curtain too much here?
No, no. This is exactly what I want to hear. So you're covering your crimes, pretty much.
Yes. You want to cover that all up. Now I know. I have an idea when I shoot the initial speech that I think, okay, great. You know, I'm taking this 10 minutes, going to go down to one. I have an idea that I'm going to need probably 8 cutaways. And so I make sure I get 8 to 10 cutaways. I do overshoot a little bit just in case you need,
those cutaways, that's sometimes, is that the thing that sometimes also referred to as B-roll?
That could be B-roll. I tend to, B-roll is kind of a catch-all because you have cutaways in this case, or you have inserts or just action stuff. Mm-hmm. I also shoot inserts. So if he's talking about, popping a balloon, I'll get a close-up shot of maybe the guy blowing up a balloon or something, some bit of action that I can get a close-up of later on, not while he's talking. We deal with that later.
So during that speech, you make a mental note of the things that you might need to kind of add in as additional material.
For example, recently I was at the Goodwood Festival of Speed shooting a bunch of interviews with car racing guys. And they'll sit and talk about their $50 million Ferrari and standing next to it. But so he'll say, oh yeah, this about the car, and oh, it's got this part of the engine, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as we're done, we'll have a 10-15 minute interview with the guy. We basically have to remember all the things that he talked about, and we'll go shoot close-ups of the gear shift of the engine of this. So that later on I'm not doing the cutting, but whoever's doing it can cut it together.
So you're just feeding them material, pretty much.
Right.
Very cool.
But what I don't want to do is just shoot and go, okay, here you go. Now make a story. That gets very, very, that'll drag you down.
I know. I'm in the middle of that right now. Mm-hmm. It's coming together. It's slowly coming together.
One of the important things, though, is you were there when it happened. That's key. Is because if you're handed just a hard drive of, okay, here, you weren't here when this was shot, here, take this and make it into something, which I've had to do.
Because you have to watch every single bit. Whereas I was there and I remember what happened when, and I'm still close enough to it to not have forgotten the important.
And that's
bits,
almost. Yeah. Everything I do is that stuff I shoot. Most of what I do is I shoot for my own edit. And then the second job is that I'll shoot for someone else to edit, but I still approach that in the way that if I had to edit it, here's how I would shoot this. So that hopefully they can look at it and go, all right, this is all the puzzles got to be put together, but at least I see the pieces. And all the pieces are there. I know all the pieces are there. I can do this. And the last job I've had to do very, very rarely. And the last time I did it, I was fired. So it was an entire documentary was shot. And it was a documentary that a very intricate story, an amazing story. But even though... Now, there's two kinds of documentaries, really, two main kinds. There's documentary of something that is happening. Like, for example, a filmmaker goes to Syria and is documenting the struggle that is occurring right now. Mm-hmm. Now, in that case, you don't know the story. You don't know how it's going to end.
Legitimate if you have not planned this, and that's legitimate to then try to find the story in the footage.
Right. I mean, oftentimes you'll find the story as you're shooting it, and you'll kind of shape it that way, but you're open to anything, and so the story can change. And then there's the kind of documentary, which shouldn't be called a documentary, still good movies, but it's you look back at the past and go, oh, okay, let's say the meme, I don't know, some of the stuff I did at Goodwood is they're talking about the 1966 battle between Ferrari and Ford. So, okay, but now that's already happened. So you know the story. So going in, you have an idea of the narrative that you want to do. And so the project I was handed, it was a story about the past, a very intricate story, but I got the sense that the filmmaker didn't know the story he wanted to tell while he was filming. And so they filmed and filmed and filmed and filmed and filmed. And I had to sit there and watch, I forget how many hours of footage. Like it took me weeks of just 8 hours a day, just watching all the raw footage and logging it all and deciding then, okay, now what's the story? How do we start?
Explain the term logging. Is that like putting keywords on things so you can find them later?
Yeah, writing down time codes. Okay, this happened here. Here's a shot of the subject doing this and this and this and talking about
that
this.
That sounds cumbersome.
Oh, it's terrible. And had I been there when we were shooting it, I would have a much better idea of, okay, good. I know we don't need this or this. I remember there's being something good in here. We can use that. But having to go back and sift through it all later, and again, not shot with any particular purpose. It was just kind of, okay, let's see what happens. And then making a story out of it is very, very difficult. So I guess my tip to the listener is don't put yourself in that position. You're honestly better off. You're better off, especially if it's a non-critical thing. Like if you're going to go out and shoot something that's you know, maybe a short 5-minute project that's not, you're not getting paid for example, and it's not someone's wedding or something critical like that, do yourself a favor and undershoot and see what happens. See what happens later, and you'll learn a lot more from that and think, okay, next time I'll shoot these 3 more shots and that's all I need. I don't have to. It's like overpacking. You don't need 9 t-shirts. Maybe you wear a dirty t-shirt one day. So what?
Mm-hmm.
There's a video version of that. Maybe yeah. You only use 2 seconds of that cutaway instead of 4 seconds. But you'll be fine. You'll learn for next time.
All right. So.
So what did you shoot this with? I'm interested to know what. First of all, did you shoot it?
Well, John shot it. I was part of the action. So I visited that associate professor, Ted Kinsman. He showed us around. And it's me asking nosy questions and having him show us stuff and include me in that one class where they did the balloon popping. And what was it
shot on?
It was shot on a DSLR, on a Canon 5D Mark III, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think John used the 24-105 lens, so he had some zoomability on it. And yeah, again, the audio track, my audio track was shot on the little Tascam DR110. Mm-hmm. No, that was Ted's audio track. My audio track was shot through a Shure radio system that John also recorded.
And that essentially became your scratch track.
Well, the scratch track is the track from the camera, which was, again, a third track. So the
I thought you said, okay, sorry, I thought you recorded your radio mic directly to the camera.
No, it was not recorded to the camera, but to a recorder that John monitored on an earpiece. So he knew my sound was good. I relied on that little box to capture Ted's sound. I tested it up front, so I was sure we were getting something good. I was very careful with the microphone placement because if you don't monitor a lavalier mic, I know from experience that it can rustle, shirt rustle, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And that can completely kill an audio track. So make it totally unusable. So I made really sure that it's free. Even if he moves, it doesn't scratch against his shirt. I'd rather have that than being able to hide a microphone away from view. I know some people do that, but I'd rather have a clearly visible mic, but one that just sounds good.
It depends on the style.
I mean, yeah, there are things where you might want to hide a microphone under a shirt and tape it to the shirt or in a wig or what I've recently seen was
my favorite is in the knot of a tie.
In the knot of a tie is cool, and what I've seen, I've of course researched that. And the one thing I've seen Adam Savage do is he hid a microphone for being on stage in his glasses. So he had that microphone on the inside of the temples of the glasses and the wire going back behind his ear along the thing. And it feels like it's far away from the mouth, but it sounds really good up there. So he was on stage with his glasses, no visible microphone, and he just, the sound guys were really happy with what he delivered.
That's a whole another show. But so for I'm glad to hear you shot with. Well, first of all, I just picked up the 24-105. It's a lens I've been avoiding. I never bought the kit lens when I bought my Mark II.
It is quite sturdy and versatile.
It is. It's one of those lenses that I've used it on a few projects. I bought it specifically for video because. A lot, like most of the times, like I'm a humongous snob and I'm shooting stuff where I have control. I have a couple of cinema lenses for the Mark III. And I have the 85mm and the 35mm by, is it Rokinon? I forget how it's branded in the different continents.
Oh, Samyang Rokinon, yeah.
Samyang, all the same thing. And so I have the T15s. For the 35 and the 85 mil lenses, and they are amazing.
Okay, wait. Before we continue on that, tell us why. I know there's a lot of companies that want to sell you cinema lenses, specific movie lenses over your DSLR lenses that you already have. Why? Mm-hmm. Why would I want a different lens? How are they different from like still lenses?
They're most likely, in my case, they are manual focus, mm-hmm. with a full barrel stock. Meaning like you have your, like the 24-105, for example, or any of your autofocus lenses they have an internal focus and an external focus ring.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to say, let's say you're to autofocus and then move the ring, there's no direct correlation between ring position and internal focus.
The ring kind of slips at the end.
Yeah, once you get to infinity, you can keep spinning. So if you want to put a mark down, like let's say you want to actually pull focus, which means you have two marks. You have mark A, mark B. So before you roll, you're gonna have your actor stand on mark one. You get focus. You put a little mark on the tape that's on the barrel of your lens. Have them walk to the second position. Refocus. And put a second mark on the tape that you put on the barrel of your lens. Now, when you go to shoot, you don't even have to look at them. The focus puller can go from mark one to mark two on the lens, and they'll be in focus the whole way.
Okay.
Now, you can't do that on the autofocus lenses because if you bump it, now those physical external marks will no longer line up.
Right.
Most likely. So there is that. And then these cinema lenses have the aperture on the barrel themselves instead of dialed in on the back of the, in the Canon case, the wheel on the back of the camera.
Right. So you operate that aperture directly on the lens. That's a physical connection again.
Yes. And there's no F6.3,
uh-huh.
which is very important. I mean, they deal in, you know, F2, 2.8 and in between there's no clicks in between. There's no third of a stop in between. It's basically an analog.
It's a smooth transition between
correct.
The different.
So they call it de-clicked. And it's very, very handy. You can dial it up and down, you know, mid shot if you need to, and it's quiet, et cetera, et cetera. But I love these, and they're extremely good at one thing. They're extremely good at being a very fast 85mm lens.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to do the run and gun and run around and shoot, which I was doing, for example, at Goodwood, I was part of the camera crew. There's two or three shooters on any given shoot. So I wasn't responsible for all focal lengths. In my case, I was lucky. I was in shooting in tight. So I just shot with the 85mm. That was fine. But on a lot of the shoots, you have to shoot very, very quickly. You don't have time to quickly change lenses. Let alone carry that lens. Like they're a hassle to carry everything around with you if you're going to run all over the place and shoot.
Right.
You don't want to also have a backpack full of lenses that you then have to take off and switch over to the 35, get the wide, pop the 85 back on, get the close. So I bought the 24-105 kind of reluctantly because I'm not a humongous fan of zoom lenses in general. Not a huge fan of F4. I mean, I like shooting at F4, but I don't like it to be my maximum.
Mm-hmm.
But I picked it up and I got to tell you, I love that lens for shooting video. It's great. It's got the built-in IS, which is fantastic for handheld stuff. It's not a solution to holding the camera still. You still want to hold the camera still.
But it takes those little jitters out.
That's the big thing it does.
Yeah.
is...
Especially with the longer focal length, every tiny movement you would otherwise see in the video.
Yeah, normally I wouldn't shoot handheld at 105 mils, but with the IS, you can do it.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Providing, I mean, I suggest getting an eyepiece too, but that's something separate. But so if you want to invest in the cinema lenses, I highly recommend the Rokinons. They're sort of the much cheaper version. You can get the very, very expensive ones. But the Samyang ones, I actually like the fact that they're cheap. They're not cheaply built. They're built very well. They're sharp enough, but I don't think they're quite as sharp as the $4,000 lenses, which I happen to like.
But for most people who want to get into shooting video on their cameras, on their still cameras, that's not a requirement. You can totally get away with your 50 1.8 and shoot.
Oh, more than get away with it, you're going to get great results.
Yes. So the cinema lens is one of those things. If you have a specific shooting style, once you shot for a few years, that's something you might want to look into, but not from the start.
But okay, let's take someone who's going to be is a still shooter, wants to shoot around with video a little bit. I would say the first thing you do is get the lens you just mentioned, get the 50mm f1.8 or the 1.4 if you want to spend a couple extra bucks. But you'll do just fine with the 1.8 for, I guess you can get the knockoff version for around $60 now.
All right. Yeah, and that's plenty good for the beginning.
Oh, that's you're going to get great video, and you're off and running. Do you want to get into all the settings really quickly, or...
Say it again.
Do you want to get into all the settings, like the basic settings?
No. Let's do a quick list of like what do you need to get started if you haven't done that before. If you want to get somewhat professional video, so that kind of a lens is a good starting point. Mm-hmm. From an audio point of view, do you need an external recorder, or could you just like if your camera has a microphone port, could you just plug in a long cable with a microphone?
You could do that. I mean, you could run, I suggest getting an external. If you're going to have an external mic, if you're going to spend the money on an external mic, I would buy one of these Tascam mic packs.
Mm-hmm.
I have three of them, and I also have the version that snaps onto the fishbowl mic itself. I have a shotgun mic, a Sennheiser ME66 that I use with, I also have a Zoom, H4N, which I like. I love
that's
the thing.
Recorder.
That's a recorder.
Yeah.
But sometimes I want to go even lighter. And so I have the Tascam. It's the exact same unit that records with the lav mics that you have, but it actually has the XLR end to it, and it plugs directly into the mic, into the boom mic, and basically just records digital right out of the mic.
Mm-hmm.
So I would get something like that. If you're going to spend the money, first of all, I would probably get the one that you have. Get that lav mic, and that's all you're going to need.
Another advantage of like a 51.8, because it's a pretty bright lens, is that you can often get away without additional light, right?
Yes. Yeah, you can shoot everything at 1.8, depending on your camera. And
you have to be good at focusing, though, if you shoot everything at 1.8.
Okay, that becomes the issue, yes. but you that's something you can work on. A lot of factors. If that's the case, if you're really worried about focus, the next thing you should look into, once you start getting good, is I would suggest getting an external eyepiece. This was a massive game changer for me. I found that like I just holding the camera and looking at the LCD screen, I just felt like a soccer mom. I didn't like that too much.
Okay, so with an eyepiece, you mean one of these things that you put on the back of your camera on the screen, and it has a magnifying glass in it, and you hold this to your eye.
You hold this to your eye. So I have the Zacuto Z Finder. There's cheaper versions. Definitely, I would suggest getting one of these. It allows you to get a really good view of the LCD screen, keep everything in focus. It also adds another point of contact, meaning you're holding the camera against your face, which helps steady your shot.
All right. That's important. Yeah.
That is that's wildly important, because you'll find that, okay, all of a sudden it's very, very shaky, especially if you don't have the IS. Now, you can get one for relatively cheap, $100, $150, I think. The next thing I would look at, even if you have an external mic, I recently picked up one of the little mini shotgun mics.
Rode something?
Yeah, Rode Micro something.
So that's one that goes on your flash hot shoe on top of the camera.
Right.
And then points. And are they, I mean, okay, they will probably let you get a bit further away from a subject with it still sounding good as compared to the built-in microphone, right?
It does. It does a great job. Very directional. I am surprised. I'm genuinely shocked at the quality. Again, I think it was around $60, maybe 50 euros or something like that, which I thought, okay, how good can this be? The reviews were great. I thought, I'll try it. If I don't like it, I'll send it back. I didn't send it back. I love the thing. It's cool. Got a little 1/8-inch stereo cable that plugs into your camera. The power runs off of your camera's power, so it's very, very simple. It's not going to replace your lav mic, but it will provide a much better scratch track and possibly a usable audio track.
I am looking at it right now. It's 45 euros, 46 euros. Rode right. Video Micro. You need a microphone plug on your camera, though.
Yes. Don't most of them have them?
Well, there are some that don't, so that's why I'm bringing that up.
Okay, yes. Make sure you have one first before you do that. So with that you should be off to the races. That's pretty much going to get you started into shooting, into what you need. The main tip I would say, skill wise, forget all the settings. You can find those online. Have a very solid understanding of depth of field, mm-hmm. how to achieve it, what it is for the aforementioned focus. Be very familiar with manual mode on your camera, and that's it. You're set.
Well, and then you need a project. Something to document, something to practice on. So mm-hmm. with your friends, with your family, it could just be a barbecue, could just be something that you want to kind of make a little few minute vignette out of. I think that's kind of good practice project. I remember you and I, we did something back when I lived in Tübingen, little, I think 1 minute video about loading film into, like loading roll film, 120 roll film into an old camera. Mm-hmm. And I had that idea that I wanted to make a little thing, a video out of that. I'm going to link that in the show notes. And the second idea I had was I want to have this all be very close up, very macro. So I remember us putting together the different steps and shooting them with a little slider, very like planned shoot. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's focus from here to there. And in the end, that was a good project to learn, because we ended up shooting, I don't know, maybe 3:1, like mm-hmm. really tight, as little as possible, with just like a couple of tries for each of the things to make sure we had some choice. And then editing that together was a breeze. And
sure.
I still love how it came out. So that, yeah, that good memories, good learning experience. And you had fun shooting it.
I absolutely did. Yeah. And I'd never shot a project quite like that. So getting to shoot all this macro, I think we shot a lot with you had the 100 mil macro, didn't you?
It was the 100 millimeter f/2.8, 3.5 macro lens. I think that mm-hmm. was the only lens we shot that with, and I still love it. Yeah,
and still, I think still we used the roller skate dolly.
There was a little dolly slider kind of thing that we used for that. So instead of doing a focus rec, we'd move the camera from A to B and make sure that mm-hmm. all falls in place.
In essentially, there's been no better time to get into doing something like this. Like when I was a kid, I was really interested in all this. So I would go out and shoot. Like my friend had a video camera that had a long cable that you plugged into your VHS machine. And so you had to hit record on the VHS and et cetera, and shoot, and then somehow edit it. You'd have two VHS machines. One would play, one would record, and you had to make all these linear edits. And that was a lot of fun. What's available to kids now, or adults for that matter, I don't know why I said it like adults, what is available for the price that's available is mind-blowing. To go and shoot HD, and forget about 4K. If you're listening and think, oh man, I got to get something that's 4K, you don't. Don't worry about it. Just shoot with your 1080p. It's awesome. What's available to you, and then to go into, I mean, there are cheap versions of video editors. I mean, I even think that what Final Cut Pro is pretty cheap nowadays.
I don't know the price. I bought it once and kept updating. So, yeah, it's the right time to start this, and
no better time. So get out there and learn, get out there and make mistakes.
Maybe we managed to plant a few ideas, and if you have any video projects out there that you're proud of, done with your still cameras, hey, share them. Share them here. Alan, thank you so much for spending the time getting us a little insight here. You do this professionally. Where can people find you? Where's your stuff?
You can find me at alanatridge.com. Or the website for my podcast is twohosers.com, which I co-host with a guy named Adam Schwartz. We talk a little bit about video, mostly about stills. No crossover to your audience, though. No poaching.
Everyone go check out the Two Horses as well. And thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
And that was it with this episode of Tips from the Top Floor. A huge thank you goes out to the new patrons, Ryan, Jeremy, Doug, Roger, Greg, Arthur, and Stu. You guys are amazing. The sponsorships are by far not enough to finance this show, so you and all the other patrons are essential to help keep the show going. I can't thank you enough for that. If you want to join in to support TFTTF, starts at $1 and you'll be in great company. Go to tfttf.com/Patreon. That's tfttf.com/Patreon. Thank you so much. You're awesome. And of course, I'd also be happy if you could leave a little review or just a star rating on iTunes. That makes the show just a little bit more visible. Music for the show by Jeff Smith, sound partner and Hans Peter Kagrod, publishing and Slack challenges by Release Pixie, Matt Ravsitar Armstead, Slack invitations by Chief Invitation Officer CIO Rusty Russ, and the link to get on the Slack is in the show notes, tfttf.com/yslack. My name is Chris Marquardt. You'll find me on social media, including Mastodon at Chris MarquardT. Go out and take amazing photos. And I told you. Share them with the world. Be nice to each other. And happy shooting.